Welcome back to This Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm spiffy.
I am happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-controversies, YouTube is taking over the world of TV, that is. Some fascinating new data out of Nielsen last week, which looked at what was being watched on TV, really, and how TVs were being used. The share of U.S. TV viewing time for YouTube, which customers, you know, you download an app to your smart TV or your Apple TV or your Roku stick or whatever, and then you watch it on that, has risen to nearly 10%, according to Nielsen. Netflix, another streaming-only service, has only about a 7.5% share, by contrast, as a way to think about this. So YouTube, bigger than Netflix. Disney is the biggest winner here, though there's probably an asterisk, given that Hulu's share counts alongside Disney Plus's numbers. They both count toward the 11.5% share. And importantly, Disney gets credit when somebody watches a Disney channel through YouTube or other channels where you can, you know, bundle things together, right? This is all very complicated. It's annoyingly complicated. Interestingly, less than half of Disney's TV time was taken up by streaming, despite owning two of the biggest streaming apps out there, Disney Plus and Hulu. But they're doing better in this regard than, say, Warner Brothers Discovery, which has about 8% of total TV time, with less than a quarter of that taking up by streaming. Lots of people still watching linear TBS, TNT, Discovery, HBO, stuff like that, apparently. The rise of YouTube is a fascinating phenomenon. When we talk about the decline of movie going and the decrease in overall ratings of TV shows, it's not like audiences simply have stopped watching screens. They're just changing habits. I have been shocked to see some of the numbers for the Bulwark's YouTube page. I don't think I'm at liberty to discuss them, but, you know, publicly, we've got a 250,000 subscribers. It's generating a ton of views. And a lot of those people are watching via TV. They watch via the TV, which I just found very fascinating because I am a zennial, millennial, whatever. I'm basically a boomer at this point. When I watch YouTube, I watch it on my laptop or I watch it on my phone. It's not, I don't really think of it as a TV destination, but that's how lots of people watch what we're putting out there. The most profound shift, of course, is with younger generation of viewers who, by and large, aren't watching this stuff on TV. They're not actually even really being measured here. They are migrating to free ad-based user-generated content like YouTube and TikTok, you know, short-form crap that they can watch on their phones, the Mr. Beast garbage, stuff like that. And audience taste changes, of course, right? It's not like the studios haven't been nudging people toward lowest common denominator slop for years via the reality TV boom. But if I'm a studio head, I'm looking at this and I'm freaking out. I'm losing my mind because what's the point of spending $10 million on an hour of television when 1,000 people who spent nothing but their time on a YouTube video or on 1,000 YouTube videos, right, is going to capture equivalent market share, maybe more? Can something like House of the Dragon really compete with, 50 random video game tubers doing nostalgia speedruns of Super Mario Brothers 3 or Contra or whatever? Peter, this brings us to an important question. Is the future of entertainment user-generated slop made by idiots powered by shoddy AI to be consumed by gormless children vacantly gazing at their phones and YouTube TV apps while they mutter about the electrolytes being what plants crave? Is that what we're headed towards?
I think that's your future. And we're actually going to be creating a separate universe, a virtual reality just for you to live in, but like Truman Show style, where you're the only real person in it. And what you have to do is you've got to keep watching movies while they keep getting worse, and while everyone else stops watching movies. And you're just going to have to, you're going to have to endure. And then we all get to watch you as you endure this this world in which the thing that you love most is fading and declining. And everybody is just like, all I want to watch is Mr. Beast, who is not, you know, maybe my favorite, but you got to respect the hustle there.
Do you have to respect the hustle? I don't think you do, actually. I don't think you do have to respect the hustle. I think you get to mock the hustle.
Well, you
get sucks.
I think you can do either, but I think you have to respect the hustle. And I want to twist this a little bit. Last week on our bonus episode, we talked about Roger Corman. Roger Corman was the king of cheaply made schlock genre films, and he was incredibly influential in Hollywood, even though he himself didn't make didn't direct or directly make any real kind of classics, unless we want to think of them as camp or cult classics, right? Certainly none of these like movies that people look back and are like, that is a great piece of cinema, a timeless work of real art. But he influenced a whole lot of timeless works of real art, in part by mentoring younger directors, folks like James Cameron and Martin Scorsese. And so I think that what is happening on YouTube right now is that we are creating a world of Roger Cormans, of people who understand that for a lot of audiences and for a lot of, let's call them use cases for video products of content, films in some cases, crap in other cases, that doing things very cheaply is the way to go. And there is always just this resistance amongst people for new technologies that allow you to do stuff that's a lot more. Like you can make a lot more stuff if you're working on YouTube and working at those budget levels than you can if you are a Hollywood studio or, frankly, even an indie film, productions and indie studio, just because it's so much cheaper. And so this allows you to make a lot more stuff. It allows you to experiment more, and it opens up opportunities for people who are not inside the system, who don't have traditional access to studio or even indie movie financing. Because movies, this is the thing I just want to impress on listeners and just want to sort of, people have to understand that even the cheapest movies are so incredibly expensive and labor intensive to make. And what YouTube does is it allows people to make stuff that is, maybe it's not cinema, but it is at times cinematic. It has elements of cinema. It's certainly derived from the thing that we think of as cinema. And that is going to create a whole new world of art. It will also result in a lot of crap. So don't give me this, hey, but it's all bad. Much of it's bad, but much of everything is bad. And this is going to allow a lot more interesting younger people who don't have access to this, to capital and to networks of craft professionals. It's going to allow them access to making stuff and to getting their work product seen and out there. And we are going to see empires built on this. In fact, we frankly already are seeing some of those empires being built. And I think in 20 years, there is going to be a reassessment of some of the creators who are going to come up through this system. And we're going to look back, or maybe not we, but people are going to look back on them in the way that Roger Corman is looked back on now, because people will be making cheap stuff that is really interesting and creative, and makes use of these tools that did not exist 15 years ago.
Alyssa, is the answer here to just kind of sit back and accept the, the people making this cheap garbage using the AI tools that have stolen all of the content from everybody else and turned it into a puree for easy consumption by the masses?
I mean, I think it's worth doing a little bit of historical thinking and remembering that Americans have been into sort of user-generated garbage for quite some time. I was turning on my TV yesterday to navigate over to my Apple TV and watch something streaming on Disney, and what came up on network TV before I switched over was America's Funniest Home Videos. And my husband was like, oh, is America's Funniest Home Videos still a thing? I was like, America's Funniest Home Videos conquered the culture, right? Like, America's Funniest Home Videos has been around as a franchise for decades at this point, and I think is what a lot of people consume or try to sort of recreate in a way that's not spontaneous in, you know, TikTok and Reels and YouTube. And, you know, this is what virality kind of is, right? I mean, all of us remember this, video of a guy doing an interview on the BBC while his kids like run back and forth behind him, right? The sort of spontaneity of life captured at lo-fi is something that the internet has not created. And I do agree with Peter that I think that, you know, one thing that is exciting and interesting is that, I mean, I have not run the price comparisons on any of this, but I have to imagine that even a high-end iPhone is sort of comparatively cheaper than a full suite of home video equipment would have been at the outset of the home video revolution, and is, you know, set up in a way such that you can learn an enormous amount of technical stuff while monkeying around with it, right? Like, it's cheaper. It is more camera for the money in some ways. And so, like, I think we'll get a lot of garbage, but I think the ability to, you know, film your own stuff, self-distribute your own stuff. I mean, the quality of pictures that I can take of my kids is, you know, just vastly better than my parents were able to capture on cheap film cameras. And so there'll be a lot of garbage, but there's always been a lot of garbage. And there will be some pearls that emerge from all of this dross. What I found really interesting about this conversation is I feel like we and a lot of other culture analysts have spent much of our time thinking about sort of the high-dollar streamers and treating YouTube sort of as a platform rather than as a company we should have been thinking about sort of in those same conversations. I think YouTube has been sort of, you know, in a separate conversation in a way it probably shouldn't have been. And I don't really feel qualified to talk about YouTube's place in the culture because it is in some ways like, you know, it is a platform. It is, you know, an outlet for self-distribution. You know, I find myself using it a lot more as my kids have gotten interested in certain things, right? Like, they will watch individual episodes of Elmo and Friends with their nanny, or I've been showing them a lot of clips from Schoolhouse Rock, which are not, like, widely available elsewhere. Like, that's something that's great. It's not available, as far as I can tell, for me to sort of stream legally in a way that I could pay for it. And so I don't think we have entirely integrated YouTube into the streaming conversation in a way that probably would have made this conversation sort of richer and clearer all along.
Just, I want to add one thing quick here to what Alyssa said, is that just recently I was talking to someone who owns an AV production business. It's mostly live events, but they do a bunch of video production as well. And the person was trained in, you know, filmmaking. And this person has some young kids, as young as 8 years old, who he said they make videos on their phones all the time. They do a huge amount of not just photographing, but also editing video for their family and for their friends. And he was talking about the cleverness and the sharpness of his kid's video. Now, look, people talk about their kids. Is it Ray? Like, oh, it's an 8-year-old. At the same time, like, I was a film major in college for a period of time, and I learned to edit video when I was 18, 19, 20 years old. And at the time, like, it's not quite that almost no one knew how to edit video, but it was still a pretty unusual skill. Like, most people had never edited video once in their lives. And we are going to raise a generation of kids, all of whom know how to edit video in basically the way that all of us learned how to type and learn, like, without even thinking about it, right? And so what the world of YouTube and iPhones and cheap cameras and editing software everywhere is going to teach kids to think in the language of cinema and to think in the grammar of cinema in a way that I think people are really underrating as, like, this is going to change communication. In some ways, it's going to take people away from something that we all love, which is writing, and which is sort of they're going to do less long form feature journalism, you know, it's novel writing. But they're going to tell stories, and they're going to know how to tell stories visually in a way that is just native and natural to them that has never been the case before, because it's never been the case that there has been essentially, you know, nearly universal access in for anybody who is lower middle class or up to video creation and production tools.
Setting that aside, which is interesting and also vaguely terrifying, frankly, if I'm being honest.
Such an old man, but, Sonny.
But what's interesting about YouTube is that it is really at the vanguard of the fast segment of the streaming market. So fast in streaming shorthand is the free ad-supported streaming channels. And it's things like, you know, Tubi and that sort of thing. And YouTube is kind of at the forefront of that. Now, there is a paid version of YouTube, but most people, I think, watch free. It's paid for by ads. And that is, like, the dark matter of the streaming universe. You know, the amount of viewers that something like Pluto has or that Tubi has is enormous, under-discussed, and is also a real financial boon for certain indie filmmakers. You know, I had a guy on The Bulwark Goes Hollywood a few months back by the name of Abe Goldfarb, And he has a new movie out, or a newish movie out. It's called First Time Caller. And he was like, look, when I'm talking to people in my space, you know, people who aren't putting movies in theaters, who aren't doing a ton of, transactional business on VOD or whatever, the way they make money is Tubi. The way they make money is Pluto. They get checks every couple weeks, and they're not, you know, enormous amounts of money, but it's like a steady stream of income, and that is just from people stumbling onto something and watching it. Maybe they don't even watch the whole thing. They just watch, you know, a couple of ad breaks, but we still get that money. And look, that's a good thing for sure. But it's also, look, again, I just worry about how are like the people who make things that are real and not the crap that is 99% of YouTube content, how are they supposed to compete with a never-ending flood of garbage, especially with a generation who was raised just like accepting that 99% of everything should be garbage and they shouldn't really have any standards?
I think this has always been a challenge. There have always been a huge number of low-quality options or options that are perceived as low-quality. And quality things have always struggled in some ways, or often struggled, at least as sort of in the modern world, certainly post-war, but even before that, you know, but then the other thing is that things that are perceived as low quality at the time often later are understood retroactively, that the best of them are understood retroactively as this is actually great. And you look at serial fiction from the late 1800s, Charles Dickens. You look at, you know, comic books and, you know, some of the stuff that was being published in the 1940s through the 1960s in science fiction magazines that was perceived by the literati, by the elite tastemakers and the, you know, sort of the gatekeepers of high class or even upper middle brow culture just saw this stuff as trash, and then it created our world. And there's a lot of great stuff that is derived from that. And I don't want to overstate this case and say that everything that is being created, or even that most of what is being created, is wonderful. But the gems, the diamonds will surface over time. And the Across the Movie Aisle podcast, it's going to be, I'm sorry, the Across the Movie Aisle AR experience that 30 years from now with our successors, we'll look back and think, you know, Sonny was wrong about this and Peter was right, because they will be able to tell us which of the YouTube creators, were in real time making just wonderful things that stood the test of the time, but they'll be really mad about whatever is being created for their, you know, their brain implants in 2045.
You won't even need successors, though. You'll just have some open AI guy upload all of our podcasts into their program, and it'll create a free version of us just stealing all our stuff. That's fine. That's fine, right, Peter? That's just progress.
We got to make like Reddit and charge them $60 million a year to do it.
All right, so what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that YouTube is taking over the TV world? Peter?
It's a non-controversy, but it is a controversy if you are a studio executive. And this is something that I have, I've had some conversations about, is that studio executives are only just now waking up to the fact that they have been competing with YouTube and YouTube-like services for a long time, that when you release a big budget movie, you have the option to go see The Marvels, but you also have an option to just sit at home with your phone watching whatever YouTube serves up to you. And like those things are substitutable goods. And so it's a controversy that people whose job is to know this stuff have only just figured it out.
Alyssa?
I think it's a non-controversy.
I think it's a controversy. Ban YouTube. Fire the YouTube servers into the sun. All right. Labor Day coming up. We are skipping this week's bonus episode. Maybe somebody can create an AI version of this show and they'll put it up for everybody to enjoy. That'll be awesome and amazing. We'll all love it. And now on to the main event. The Idea of You. The Idea of You stars Anne Hathaway as Selene, an absurdly named single mother who owns an art store in Silver Lake, Los Angeles.
An
art gallery?
That's what they call them. Art stores.
A place to buy art.
Yeah, it's like a Pottery Barn, but boutique.
And she takes her daughter Izzy and Izzy's friends to Coachella to see a boy band perform, only to find herself wooed by boy bander Hayes, played by Nicholas Galitzine? something? I don't know. Girl meets boy, but girl resists boy's charms. Girl gives in and becomes tabloid fodder, and then girl leaves boy. It's a typical love story. Tale as old as time. I'm fascinated by this movie because it doesn't really work on any level. It's fourth-rate Nicholas Sparks. It's not funny enough to be a rom-com or romantic enough to be a rom-com. It's shot in a way that calls to mind the worst of Netflix mush, and it's a fairly big hit for Amazon Prime. I have long thought that terrible and cheap romance movies are an underutilized avenue of audience growth for the streaming services, and this is yet more proof of that. Just as a movie qua movie, look, I am not the target audience for this film, despite the fact that I led the charge against the so-called Hatha haters that rose to prominence when Anne Hathaway was a genuine A-lister. She's winning Oscars, she's putting up huge box office, and people hated her for it. They hated her success, and I always thought that was unfair and weird. Weird is one of the weirder moments of the internet, more than anything else. I think she's delightful. I'm glad to see her succeed, even in a movie like this that doesn't really work at all. And it doesn't work at all, at least in part, because she's kind of wrong for this movie. Alyssa, I remember you I think you sent us a headline, piece headlined in The Cut. It was titled, I think, something like, Anne Hathaway is too hot for this movie, too hot for The Idea of You. Assuming it was just another, and I saw that headline, I was like, this is just another iteration of Hathaway derangement syndrome, but it's actually kind of correct. Like, the whole point of this movie, which is the equivalent of like a middle-aged mom superhero movie, right? It's like, this should be an MCU-style wish fulfillment, it could happen to you thing, right? It should be like the 40-year-old woman version of Spider-Man or Captain America, where like a nerdy guy gets powers and everybody loves him, right? That sort of thing is very appealing. I understand that. I think that's why, like, the 50 Shades of Grey movies work to the extent that they work, right? Because Dakota Johnson is kind of like that. But, like, Hathaway is one of the most beautiful women on the planet. Her character lives in what is probably, like, a $5 million house in the middle of Los Angeles. She's going to Coachella with VIP passes. Like, how is the average person supposed to put herself into her shoes? It doesn't make any sense. If I owned an art store and I had boy banders coming in, I would not be a normal person. That's just not how it works. And so as a result, like, even her wins in this movie don't resonate at all. Like, for instance, there's this running subplot in which Selene, again, her name is Selene, her ex-husband shows up with his new wife, and the new wife keeps trying to be nice to her, or girlfriend, or whatever she is, and Selene resents this, right? Understandably, because this homewrecker destroyed her marriage. And you can see how this would feel funny, right? It's like a comedic moment. But it's never actually funny. It's always just kind of mean-spirited. And by the end of the film, when the homewrecker is saying she's leaving the husband, and, you know, she just wants to be friends, and Selene's like, get out of here. There's no catharsis. It's all just weird. It's, like, weirdly petty. It didn't work. It didn't work. The one perfect piece of casting in this film is Reed Scott as the cheating husband.
Yes.
Reed is best known to audiences probably as Dan from Veep, and he just has the perfect amount of rich douchebag smarm throughout. Like, just a guy you love to hate. He's excellent in this. I don't know, Alyssa. Like I said, not a movie for me. More, I think, a movie aimed at your particular demographic. So I'm willing to fully concede that I am just missing the appeal here. What did you make of The Idea of You?
I am very much the target audience for this movie, right? I like Selene. I'm turning 40 this year. I am not divorced. My husband is awesome. But, you know, it's like, I've got my kids. I grew up on boy bands. I grew up on Anne Hathaway, right? Whether in, The Princess Diaries or The Devil Wears Prada or her, really fun turn of Selena Kyle and Christopher Nolan's Batman movies. And yet this movie just did not land for me. There are a bunch of problems with it, some big, some sort of annoyingly small. But I think the big one is that the script doesn't actually do anything interesting with the way that it set up the age gap. And it does something interesting conceptually in that it takes both of its characters, the one who's 39 and the one who's 40, the one who's, 23, 24?
He's 24.
He's 24.
They are supposed to be 40 and 24.
Yes. And has them both sort of defined by choices they made when they were very young, right? Like Selene, has a 15-year-old daughter implying that she, 15 or 16-year-old daughter.
16.
Implying that she, thank you for all of the fact checking, Peter. That, you know, she had a kid at 24, which for a woman of her sort of socioeconomic status and educational status is, you know, more unusual than not these days. Hayes, you know, auditioned for this boy band when he was 14, and like the entire course of his life has been set by that. But the movie never really does anything either, you know, sort of with the fact that both of them are people who probably sort of like have some growing up to do, and doesn't really do much sort of fruitful with that tension. It also, I was sort of interested by the extent to which the movie just doesn't mention fertility at all. You know, that potentially would be a big thing for a woman who's 40 and a guy who's 20, who's 24. The question of like, can we go the distance? Is this something that's going to get serious very quickly because you want to have kids? How does she feel about having another kid? It's just something that would be a very natural thing to come up and provide sort of a source of tension in that kind of relationship. And the movie just doesn't touch it at all. And so, you know, Celine doesn't really, you know, when we see her in the first scene of the movie, she's packing to go on this camping trip because she's, you know, she's sort of newly divorced, her daughter's more independent, and she's trying to figure out, like, what the hell she likes and wants. And the only thing that the movie suggests that she learns about herself is that, like, this young kid's, like, pretty sexy. It's fun to bang him all around Europe. But, like, we don't see any way that she changes, like, does she want to run a gallery forever? Like, does she want another kid? Does she, like, it doesn't really do anything with sort of personal growth for her in a way that just feels sort of underbaked and underexploited. Second, it's not even a very good boy band romantic comedy. And boy bands have been fodder for a bunch of fun movies in recent years. You know, there's The Lonely Island's Pop Star Never Stop Stopping, which is like very funny, has, you know, really good sort of fake songs. Turning Red has like an excellent sort of a silly boy band subplot. And then there's the sort of boy band musicals, boy band romantic comedy to beat all boy band romantic comedies, Music and Lyrics, which plays Hugh Grant as a songwriter who's like sort of trying to, you know, establish a musical career after having been in like ABBA, essentially. And this movie takes boy bands a little bit too seriously. Like, there is not enough edge in sort of the songwriting or the self-presentation in a way that just makes it much less fun to watch. It does very little with the internal group dynamics. And it's just like, it's an odd, it's just a little bit odd. And it made the movie much less fun for me to watch. But then also there's just a big sort of plot arc problem, which is, can we discuss spoilers?
Sure, spoilers. Okay.
So
there's barely anything to spoil in this movie. It's exactly what you think it's going to be, and nothing more.
With the exception of just a really dumb twist at the end, which, so, like, Celine and Hayes break up twice. Three times? Is that right? I cannot.
Really, twice.
Twice.
They like, so don't get together, then they're together, they break up, and then they break up.
So they break up because Celine has some trust issues. Hayes, like, initially sort of picked her up the way that he's picked up people in the past, which, like, I mean, that's how people date, sorry. And then when they break up again, it's because it involves, like, their relationship has just put so much pressure on Izzy that Celine decides, like, it's the wrong thing to do to continue dating him. And that's, like, objectively the correct decision, right? Like, she's a mom, however good Hayes is in bed, like, her kid actually should come first. But then the movie does this dumb thing where it's like, you know, like, maybe in 5 years we'll get together, and then has them get together. And weirdly, this comes on the heels of, and just like that, the Sex and the City reboot doing the same thing. In the most recent season, where, like, Carrie gets back together with Aiden, her, you know, former fiancé, but then, like, Aiden's kids turn out to have some trouble, and it's, like, he has to stay in rural Virginia or wherever he lives. He can't move to New York. And so it's, like, it's a very weird move, right? Because it gives you the happy ending without any of the, like, how do we resolve these differences in sort of worldview and, you know, status. And it's just, like, it's a very weird cheat code. That I find irritating because good romantic comedies do actually work through the stuff that keep couples apart. And this movie just totally cheats on that. I found it very annoying.
Alyssa, it's interesting that you say it doesn't take boy band seriously enough. I the one thing that kept jumping out to me is how disinterested Selene is in the whole boy band thing at first. Like, it's almost like she wants, it's almost like the movie wants her to be too cool for boy bands, which is a problem in and of itself, again, from like the weird wish fulfillment angle. But, and also the internal group dynamics are all bad and wrong and like not sketched out at all. It's fine. So I watched this movie with my wife and she was like, that boy band has one real person in it and one person with kind of a personality. And then the rest of them are just blanks. Like, what's the deal here?
Which, in fact, is like very counter to the way boy bands are designed, right? Like,
right.
Each, you know, and same as like the Spice Girls being the most sort of like blatantly obvious example of this, but like you're supposed to have a set of different personalities and looks in the band. So there's something for a lot of different like girls, mostly some women, to sort of latch onto and then argue over, right? Like that,
right.
And that even becomes the source of a joke at the end of the movie where Selene's ex is like, you know, you're like banging the guy that our daughter had a poster of on her wall since she was like 8 years old. And Selene's like, no, it was the other member of the band. You don't know her at all, right? It's like, but I couldn't tell you what any of the other guys in the band's like names
there
were.
There is a brief scene in which her dude outlines which of the members of the band have which personality, and his personality is I'm British, which tells you something about the movie. Which is that this guy has no, like, there's not enough personality for the male love interest. He is almost entirely a hot young blank who the closest we get to any kind of real information about him is he has a little bit of conflict with his dad and he's been doing acting type stuff since he was a kid.
Yeah. And it's interesting because Nicholas Galitzine is being really positioned as like the young heartthrob, right? I mean, he is in this. He is in, you know, he plays one of the like two main romantic leads in the adaptation of Red, White, and Royal Blue, which was incredibly popular. He's in Bottoms. He was the prince in Cinderella, right? Like he is being just very, very, very heavily sold as this like smoldering romantic lead. And I'm sorry, Nicholas Galitzine, but you are no young Leonardo DiCaprio, just like not even close. He's just kind of gormless. He doesn't have the range.
Gormless. Second time gormless comes up in this podcast. Excellent. Peter, what did you make of the idea of you?
On the gormless note, I was just thinking about how much better this movie would have been if you somehow or another could have cast an appropriately aged version of Channing Tatum. Because Channing Tatum would have understood kind of instinctively that this character needs some sort of goofy edge, even if you're not going to tell us very much about him, right? Like, even if he's going to be a little bit of that, like, vague blank that you often get in female-targeted romantic stories where the guy isn't supposed to be too specific so that you can project whatever you want on him. Channing Tatum understands he needs just something, like, a little bit of friction there, a little bit of interest. Yep,
like,
that,
the,
like,
the She's All That vintage Channing Tatum would have been perfect in this movie. Yeah.
He's too old at this point. He could not have played that role effectively in 2024, but Channing Tatum is the thing. A young Channing Tatum is what this movie needed and didn't have. I agree with Alyssa completely that this movie just doesn't have there's just not enough there. It is too vague and too just focused on, well, you know, she's older and he's younger, and what else? What does that mean? Let's explore that in a specific way. Who are these people? Right? You can't, even though you get a few details about their lives, they just don't pass the, can you imagine them having normal lives off screen outside of this plot test? They exist entirely in, they only exist in scenes that are designed to explore this one very narrow, very shallow thing in the most boring possible way. And there is just not enough to the movie. And this is, it's a real problem for a movie that wants to be about relationships, because relationships are complicated. And what makes them interesting is that the people are complicated and have a bunch of different aspects, right? Like even the most boring person in the world is boring in a specific way. If you get to know them, they have things that they do in their life that are right. And if they're really truly like uninteresting people, then that itself becomes a source of conflict and tension. This movie just doesn't have any of that. It's far too sort of, it goes down far too easily. And it doesn't want to actually take some of these, take its central conflict and take it to a point of real hurt, real pain, or real conflict, which is what which is what this story wants to do.
It also, in terms of like doing anything interesting with the age gap stuff, it feels like there's something very off about the scene where she's like at this villa and is super, super intimidated by these very young girls who are there. And if you're going to and like ends up, you know, coming out in this like frumpy moon is like, I have a history of skin cancer, right? Like just like makes her like really old and frumpy in that scene. And if you're going to do that, a movie like this needs a sort of revenge scene where you see just like how much more sophisticated and interesting she is than like, you know, these girls in their tiny bikinis are basically just being like schlepped around, right? Like, you know, she has access to all of this money. Like, show her looking just like much more sophisticated and sexy and well-dressed than like a bunch of like pseudo teenagers in Fashion Nova bikinis. And the movie is just sort of like rather it's a scene that weirdly just like humiliates her instead of setting this up to be like a fun fantasy. It's also
just not a plot. It's a one note sort of like, well, I guess it would be awkward that most of the other guys are traveling around with 24-year-old or 20-something girls, and they think of her as like weirdly old, as awkwardly old. And then it's just like, well, it's awkward. It doesn't have anything else to say beyond that. It doesn't develop any of this in any real way. It's also a bizarre scene for her to be putting on a one-piece bathing suit and then a cover-up and et cetera and be feeling awkward not 10 minutes after a montage that shows her looking like Anne Hathaway in a very tiny two-piece bathing suit.
Yeah.
Again, not in front of those girls, so maybe the conflict is she's afraid to, but like, it's like, what do you have? You're Anne Hathaway. And this is the way in which she is too hot for this movie, even though the movie's, part of the point of the movie is that she's exceptionally attractive, and it's exploring that. No, but so I was trying to, I was thinking, like, Sonny, this movie is not targeted at me. And one thing you can do with a movie that's not targeted at you is just being like, I don't like this, it's girl stuff, right? But I was trying to think about how I could try to appreciate this. And the way I was thinking was, what if this is like a middle-aged woman's version of a Jean-Claude Van Damme movie? And I like Jean-Claude Van Damme movies, I mean, to some degree. Like, certainly at 1 a.m., I will turn on, I don't know, it's Sudden Death or Double Team or one of these things from the 1990s, if it happens to be on, if I see the tile on Netflix or whatever. I'm not some super fan expert in these things, but I just kind of enjoy the sort of punchy, big man, kickboxy crappiness of them. Those movies are dumb fantasies. They're for the most part not all that good, but they're kind of effective at what they are. They certainly don't have deep, rich, interesting characters that they're exploring. It's not literary in any way. And maybe that's what this movie is. The problem is this movie wants to explore something that isn't just like punching and kicking. It wants to explore an actual social idea about two people who are supposed to represent something like real people. But then it doesn't want to do that. It absolutely refuses at every point to do any of the literary work of telling this story. Because what it's actually interested in is Anne Hathaway is beautiful, this guy's hot, and they exist entirely in these rarefied, no-conflict environments where the only thing they really have to think about is, you know, is it really right for the two of them to be together? And that's just not how life is. Even people who have a lot of money and are beautiful have conflict and complications in their life. And it doesn't work. Whereas, like, Jean-Claude Van Damme in Sudden Death or whatever doesn't have that many complications. It's supposed to be about the punching.
The movie also relies for its plot on a sort of celebrity gossip culture that would have handled this actual relationship quite differently, I think. Like, it's very sort of 2015 era, like the fact that there's like Perez Hilton in there,
being sort of
exceptionally nasty.
Yeah.
And when in fact, like, there are a number of younger guys in Hollywood who have had these relationships with older women, like Aaron Taylor Johnson, for example, is, you know, as far as I know, still with Sam Taylor Johnson, who's much older than he is. They have a couple of kids together. And, like, there are periodic kind of snarky things about that, but it's, like, often been a vehicle for him to talk about, like, make himself sound sort of more sophisticated and, like, appreciative of what a real woman is like. Bo Burnham, for a long time, had, a significantly older partner. And, like, in fact, in the real world, Solane and Hayes would have gotten a lot of the kind of press that this movie has gotten about how, like, it's kind of daring and interesting and, like, oh, he must be sophisticated. And, like, actually, this normal woman is, like, such an interesting fox. And isn't it cool that it's happening to her? But none of that can exist in the universe of the movie because it needs a very different kind of tabloid narrative to work for the plot. And, like, it wouldn't work just, you know, structurally and narratively, if there was a more complicated media narrative.
Well, it might. I mean, you could take this plot and make a version of this movie in which there was less pressure or less totalizing pressure to leave him for the sake of Izzy. What if, in fact, she had moments where she felt like, actually, this is burnishing my image too, right? Yeah. This is, people are giving me credit for being sophisticated in a way that I kind of enjoy. Allow her to, the only thing she's allowed to enjoy in this movie are the rich furnishings, you know, the private jets and incredible hotels and his body. And that's great, right? That's something, but it's like, that's it. It reduces that the pleasures of the relationship to he's an attractive young man and there's a lot of money associated with this relationship.
Yeah. Well, and it would be interesting if there's an interesting version of this movie where she kind of becomes the asshole, right? Where, like, she, you know, kind of gets famous and gets high in her own publicity and, like, she's the one who ends up being, like, sort of a bad parent to Izzy, not the paparazzi.
And yeah. That would have enlivened and enriched that relationship with her child, which I think is also pretty milquetoast in the way that it's presented.
Yeah, but again, I think the point of this movie, again, is to be, right, the sort of wish fulfillment.
That's like, correct.
You don't want to see yourself being mean to Izzy if you're a, you know, middle-aged mom watching this on a Saturday night after the kids have gone to bed. One thing that jumped out at me was, again, just how incredibly unfunny it was, like, for a rom...
For a rom-com, for a movie made by a former cast member of The State, weirdest, funniest sketch comedy shows ever.
That's what I wanted to mention here. So it's directed by Michael Showalter, who was one of the members of The State, one of the funniest shows on TV. He wrote Wet Hot American Summer. He directed The Big Sick, which, again, is, like, a very funny movie. I don't think that movie entirely works either, but, like, it's undoubtedly funny. That's a very funny film. And then this is, man, it is a... it really does look like a TV show, like, not even, like, a really good TV show, like a, you know, I don't know, like, late 90s NBC sitcom level shooting. I was just, the whole thing was just blah for me. I watched, I was like, blah.
Yeah. No, it's really not fun the way that it should have been.
Well, it's pretty in the way of catalog for home furnishings, right? When there's a kind of genericness to the prettiness of the movie, but it doesn't allow for anything that is particularly interesting. There's no grain or grit to it because it has decided to eliminate all of the real conflict of actual life from a story about someone's life because that's not what they assume that viewers want. On the other hand, it's been successful enough that seems like maybe that is accurate.
Yeah. All right, so what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on the idea of you, Alyssa?
Thumbs down, unfortunately.
Peter?
I thought Anne Hathaway was reasonably good in an extremely underwritten part, but sadly, thumbs down.
Thumbs down, bad movie. Okay, that's it for today's show. Many thanks to our audio engineer, Jonathan Siri, without whom this program would sound much worse. Tell your friends, strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter, @SonnyBunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.